4 o'clock. Do I have that right, y'all? I count Mindy, Jim, Kenny. Yeah, we've got a quorum. Okay, I am going to get this meeting started with the call to order, and I am going to read the statement aloud to get the meeting started. The Commission on Equitable Housing and Development meeting has now commenced. It is November 14th, 2024, at 4 p.m. This is a virtual meeting. We ask that you mute yourselves until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. For those who have dialed in using the call-in number, to unmute to speak, dial star six on your phone, and that you only use the chat function to request to speak. Also, to comply with the state open meeting law, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio. And I will do the roll call now. Maggie Amato-Tellez.
Present.
Wendy Asher. Do not see Wendy. Mary Ann Beerling.
I'm here.
Mindy Bernstein.
Present.
Mark Clark.
Present.
Vicki Cusino. Don't see Vicki on the list. Serena Waraki. Lori Meserbo.
Present.
Tisha Tallman.
Here.
Jim Toffel.
Here.
Ray Winch. Don't see Ray. Kenny Wong.
Present.
Jay Young, that is me. And then we have the ex officio members, Ann Chineka. See Ann logged on yet. Corin Manning. Marcos Ismail. And I thought I saw Marcos.
Here.
Marcos is here. And then Mike Edmonds. I do not see Mike. We do have a quorum. Without objection, I would like to approve the September meeting minutes. Are there any updates or anything that needs to be changed with the meeting minutes before we approve them? Going once, going twice. The meeting minutes from the last meeting are approved. And jumping into the agenda, we do have a request to change up the order just a bit. I know that Anne wanted to hop on at the beginning of the meeting because she needs to leave early. However, I do not see her on the meeting. Am I missing that? Is Anne on the call right now? On
I'm
the
not seeing Anne on the call.
I'll go check.
Okay.
I'm hearing her walk into her office right now, so give her just like 5 minutes.
We do have Sophia Blue from the county if we wanted to move to that item to just get a quick update from the Pima County Housing Commission.
Without objection from the rest of the commissioners, I would like to go ahead and have the county commission report. So that would be wonderful, unless there's objection.
Should we ask our the people who are giving these presentations from Arches and the Bar Association if they what how that affects their schedule?
We can, although I mean, I think the county folks will just take a few minutes. So I think we need to go ahead and get that done if they're going to present. So let's just go ahead and get that out of the way real quick. Is
Okay.
it
Thanks,
so?
Jay.
Yeah, go
Sorry,
ahead.
Jay.
Okay.
We don't have like a presentation,
Yeah,
but
great.
we could do like a quick update. But yeah,
That'd be
if that's
great.
okay with everyone. Okay. So our commission, they ha did not meet last month, and they will be meeting tomorrow. So we don't have a whole like big commission update. I can say that we put out our RFP for gap funding. And the deadline for that was October 31st. I believe we got 10 applicants, and we will be evaluating those next week. We should start that process. So we'll have more information about that for our commission probably next month. The other thing was that we are wanting to get someone from you all's commission together with someone from our commission. So we'll be having some, we were just talking about this today with Sarah Megason. So we should be having something. I'm not sure what that's going to look like yet. Oh, Jim, did you have a question?
No, I just want to volunteer to
Oh,
work with you guys. So we had talked
okay,
about
great.
doing that with the affordable housing. I was actually planning on speaking tomorrow during a call to audience.
Okay, that sounds good.
Specifically, yeah, Bettibond Initiative.
We had talked, Sarah mentioned you today. So we were talking about that, and our work group was have been talking about that. So that'll be good to hear from you tomorrow. Did you have a question, Maria? Oh, can't hear you.
You
You're
just muted
on mute.
again.
I'm also volunteering for that as part of the Affordable Housing Subcommittee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mindy.
Like to volunteer as well.
Okay.
When do y'all meet?
So we've been meeting on Thursdays at 1, like every other Thursday. However, it's and as long as it's not, a subcommittee that's created out of your committee, out of your commission, because then we're gonna have to worry about what do you call it? Open meeting law. So I will get your names, and then we'll see how we can get this together, and maybe just be starting out with like your chair and our chair of our commission, kind of talking to each other. But we'll see. So is that you, Jay, the chair?
That is me.
All right. And that's all. I mean, if nobody has any other questions.
So, if I could, Sophia, we had previously discussed as a commission to have the Affordable Housing Subcommittee kind of be on point for these communications with the county. So, Jay, if you're okay, I mean, I'm chairing the Affordable Housing Subcommittee. That's the reason I volunteered.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, great. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, any other comments, questions, thoughts for Sophia?
Hey Jay, really quick. Sorry. Wendy Asher just joined the meeting. Just
Okay,
having that for the
thanks.
recording. No problem.
Welcome, Wendy. I think at this point, if there are no other questions or comments, we can move on to the update from Anne. Thanks, Sophia.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jay, and thanks for accommodating moving me up in the agenda. You may have heard we have a Tucson House meeting this evening. We meet regularly with residents about that rehabilitation project. So I'll be heading there in about an hour. So just a couple of updates from HCD. Happy to go into any more detail. But one, so we have our Sugar Hill on Stone project. That is the low-income housing tax credit project we've been working on. We had a public meeting about it yesterday evening. And so we're on track moving towards having a construction timeline February, March of next year. But we had a good public meeting yesterday. There is a, and I will ask Rachel to jump in here. I know there is a community paint day for Thrive in the 05. It is a cool Sugar Hill mural. And Rachel, can you provide info on the time and day? And I've seen cool things go out on our social media about it. So I know she has that information. But folks are invited to come paint a ginormous mural on a building.
Thanks, Anne.
Anything?
Yeah, the Sugar Hill, there will be a community paint day on Saturday, this Saturday, November 16th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And it'll be at Max's Center Attractions at 2032 North Stone Avenue. So it'll be that part of the building that faces Stone Avenue. I'm happy to send out the flyer to commissioners also if folks are interested.
Thank you. One, we had a news release that went out about a project we've been working on. So one of my big goals, really thinking about the mayor's efforts with Tucson climate resiliency, the Tucson Resiliency Plan, is really to try to add as much climate resiliency adaptations to our city-owned housing as we can. And so last year, Mayor and Council allocated funding to put some rooftop solar on some of our single family homes. And so we are currently working on adding solar panels to 15 of our single family homes, really hoping this is sort of the first of many different improvements. Last year, we worked with Tucson Electric Power to get some insulation and some other energy efficiency appliances and other features into some of our city-owned housing. So that's something we're continuing to slowly work on, but there was some news on that recently, so wanted to make sure you're aware. Very importantly, and I'll also ask Rachel at some point to put this link in the chat, Mayor and Council adopted the People, Communities, and Homes Investment Plan at last week's meeting. And so today, and I'm trying to get information out on it, but today we posted the request for proposals for our community development block grant funding, emergency solutions grant funding, home, and I missed one, and general fund. So there are four different funding sources. We put the information out today. And so for affordable housing developers, this is a big source of gap funding. As a reminder, we are asking once again, as we did last year, for developers to come present on their projects. That will be the January Commission on Equitable Housing Development meeting. So you all will be involved with the process, trying to score and determine how our funding gets spent. And so happy to answer questions on that. Couple other items that I will ask staff if they have more information, but Tucson Pima Collaboration to End Homelessness does now have blankets. And so blankets are available for agencies who are working with the unhoused. And so let us know if you have questions on that, need blankets. And then last, I know that it's been a long time coming, and I think I said this was going to happen by this month, last month, but I really believe by the December commission meeting, the Southwest Decision Resources should be under contract for the city. So that's a smattering of things, and Allison has more information.
Blanket distribution is on Tuesdays from 10 a.m. to noon in the parking lot at HCD 310 North Commerce Brick Loop. Those are just open office hours. People can stop by anytime. Andrew, I just wanted to mention Andrew Paredes he's in the attendees, which I can, if you accept our promotion, Andrew, you can turn your camera on, promotion to panelist. But he's our new, I don't know, Anne, if you want to introduce him?
Go for it. You're doing a great job.
Community development administrator, who is overseeing those RFP, PCHIP RFPs / calls for projects that Ann just mentioned. And he wanted me to mention that the information sessions for those RFPs are on, Andrew, can you say the dates and times?
November 18th. All the registration and webinar info is posted on our PCHIP page.
Yes. So that website that Rachel put in the chat has that information. And thank you, Allison, for introducing Andrew. We're so excited to have Andrew at HCD. As Elsa mentioned, he is a community services administrator overseeing our home funding and CDBG and a whole slew of things. Okay, I see one hand. Happy to answer questions. So, Jay, I'll turn it over to you to facilitate questions.
Mindy.
Thank you. Was hoping that prior to reviewing the RFP results that we could be provided information ahead of time regarding.
So we will, couple things we can share ahead of time will be, of course, the RFPs are available and we'll see, and Andrew will have to talk. I don't want to overpromise, but we'll try to put some sort of summary together so that you're not coming in blind, hearing these presentations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
And I had a question just about the facilitators. Do you think they will be available for the December meeting or?
So we can chat on that. I do think so. My understanding is they're waiting on, they still had to submit the insurance was the last piece of this puzzle. But since they're already on a city contract, I'm sort of surprised that's taking as long as it is. So we can update you. But if you would like them for the December meeting, we can shoot for that.
Yeah, we might as well try.
Great.
Any other questions or comments for HCD people? All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Moving right along, I know we're a little bit out of order now, but it looks like the next thing on the agenda is the call to the audience. The call to the audience is limited to 3 minutes per speaker and a total of 10 minutes. All speakers must share their name to be recorded in the meeting minutes. And remember, the call to the audience may not result in discussion with members of the commission. No legal action may take place during the call to the audience, and speakers may not be disruptive. CEHD members may only respond to criticism and request that items be placed on a future agenda for discussion. Members of the audience may still participate on agenda items as per the bylaws of CEHD. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak? If not, we can move on to our next agenda item. The next agenda item is a presentation, the state of housing in Arizona from the Arizona Research Center for Housing Equity and Sustainability, also known as ARCHES. Remind me who's here from ARCHES to give the presentation?
Hi, Andrea here.
Hey, Andrea, the floor is yours. Take it away.
I have a presentation I was going to share, and so I'm going to attempt to share screen right now. Are you seeing this slide? Perfect.
We are.
All right. So good afternoon, everyone. I'm Andrea Whitsett, and I am the Executive Director of Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU, and I appreciate the invitation to be here presenting today. So Morrison Institute is really honored to co-lead ARCHES, which is what the Arizona Research Center for Housing Equity and Sustainability goes by. And I wanted to acknowledge it's actually co-located. We have a shared leadership model. And so the Drockman Institute at U of A also runs ARCHES with us. And I believe Kenny Wong is on the line and he is one of the co-directors. ARCHES was actually funded by HUD through its first Hispanic Serving Institution Center of Excellence grant. And the goal of ARCHES is really to advance knowledge and evidence-based solutions related to housing challenges for Hispanic and underserved communities, both in Arizona and the Southwest. So I'm really happy to be here today to share our first annual State of Housing in Arizona report. So this report is intended to highlight the current state of housing by examining trends using publicly available data in three key areas: home ownership, rental housing, and homelessness. And the report, which I can share a link to if you haven't already received it, because I'm going to kind of move quickly at a higher level, but the report actually compares Arizona to five additional Sunbelt states. We picked these states because they have the highest Hispanic or Latino populations. So California, Florida, Nevada, New Mexico, and Texas, which I'll refer to as the comparison states. And then we also wanted to highlight some of the current state and local policy efforts that are underway to address housing issues. So high level to start, I'm just going to cover a few key population characteristics of Arizona so we can think about how our changing population intersects with our future housing needs. So projections show that Arizona is going to see continued growth. And as you can see in this chart, our population is expected to increase from 7.7 million to between 9 and 12 million by 2060. And with that growth, there will be continued pressure on the housing market. So housing supply is increasing, but it has not yet been able to catch up to demand. As you can see here, the percentage increase in households has been higher than the percent increase in housing units. And this is the case across all of our comparison states, with the exception of New Mexico. But Arizona actually has the highest, second highest supply gap, right behind Florida. So another important fact is our aging population. As you can see, we have an increasing proportion of residents who are 65 and older, and a decreasing proportion who are younger than 15. And as our population ages, we're going to have to place even more attention on people aging in place, in part because our older Arizonans who are on fixed low incomes will struggle to afford housing, and they may also struggle to navigate their homes as some of their physical abilities change. We're also becoming more ethnically and racially diverse. So in 2022, 52% of the population here identifies as white non-Hispanic. But what you can see in these bars is the percent increase by race and ethnic category. And you can see how much faster the growth is occurring in the Asian, Black, and Hispanic compared to white non-Hispanic. So this chart is showing the annual median income for the top five occupations in Arizona. And you can see that they're generally lower than the annual income that's needed to afford one and two bedroom apartments, that one exception being that bar on the right, which is for management occupations. And in 2023, among all occupations, 73% of Arizonans worked in a sector where the annual median income fell below the income needed to afford a two bedroom apartment. So the overall cost of living in Arizona has remained just under the national average. So these are the regional price parities for housing, and they compare each state to the nation. So when it comes to housing, essentially Arizona's buying power has decreased since 2019 compared to the national average. And you can see in this chart that Arizona's housing price levels closely followed those of Texas until 2020, when Arizona exceeded Texas. And in 2022, we were 6% above the national average. So next, we'll look at the characteristics of Arizona's housing stock. Single-family homes make up 69% of Arizona's housing stock, followed by five-plus unit housing at 16%, and then mobile homes at 10%. And as you can see, there is very little in the two- to four-unit housing range available here in Arizona. So while nearly 78% of all housing units permitted in Arizona since 2000 have been single family, the number of permits issued for housing with five or more units did increase in 2022 and 23, representing the highest percentage of permits for this type of housing that we've seen since 2014. So home ownership trends. In 2022, roughly 22% of home owners were cost burdened. So that's meaning 30% or more of their income is going toward their housing cost. And notably, the percentage of Arizona homeowners who are cost burdened has decreased since 2010, with this percentage reaching its lowest, one of its lowest points actually since 2022. And incomes for homeowners have grown faster than their housing costs. From 2010 to 2022, the median annual cost of home ownership decreased, right? So this probably feels a little weird, and I had to like go through my notes on this, right? But it's essentially reflecting that a lot of homeowners were able to take advantage of refinancing at lower rates. And so where we've seen the huge spike is for people who are right now trying to get into home ownership or who are in the rental market. But if you already owned your home, you're advantaged in this situation. And then I think it's worth noting, Black and Hispanic homeowners not only were less likely to refinance during that favorable time, but also accumulated significantly less housing equity among borrowers with active mortgages since February of 2021. Hispanic and Latino households comprise nearly a quarter of all Arizona households. However, only 22% of owner-occupied households are Hispanic or Latino. And this is compared to 70% of owner-occupied households being white, despite them representing 63% of households statewide. So rising home prices and interest rates pose significant barriers to entry into home ownership. From April of 2019 to April of 2023, the median sales price increased by 57%, putting it at $423,000. So compared to other Sunbelt states, Arizona saw one of the highest percentage increases in median sale price, only slightly behind Florida. And interest rates have also been at their highest point in 10 years, which of course makes buying a home even more expensive. This one's striking. A typical mortgage payment doubled from 2019 to 2023, and fewer owners are now willing to sell their current homes because if they were able to lock in a fixed low interest rate, they're really demotivated from moving within the market. So rental housing. Now, in contrast to what we saw with homeownership, Latinos and African Americans are more likely to be renters. Rents in Arizona increased by nearly 72% from 2010 to 2022, the highest among our Sunbelt comparison states. And this is really where the pain point is. So as this figure shows, the minimum wage, extremely low income and low income households have incomes that fall below the monthly rent of a moderately priced one bedroom apartment. So a minimum wage household would need to work 86 hours per week or have more than two full-time jobs in order to afford a two bedroom unit. And in 2022, nearly half of all rental households were cost burdened, which is the highest percentage that has been at since 2010. Arizona does not have enough affordable and available rental homes for extremely low income households. And as of 2022, it was estimated Arizona had a deficit of over 133,000 affordable and available units for extremely low income renters. Evictions. So the number of evictions filed in Arizona hovered around 80,000 per year from 2010 to 2019. Once the pandemic occurred, many households fell behind on rent, leading to the moratorium we all know happened on evictions. That moratorium led to a 48% decline in filings between 2019 and 2021. Then that when the moratorium was lifted, evictions spiked. And you can see that here in the chart. So, you know, evictions are really disruptive in people's lives as they're forced, can force people to move away from their current job, have kids change schools, disrupt their support systems. So it's a really tragic thing. And this is a tough increase. You see, we're up to, what was this in 2023, over 96,000 eviction filings. And then, of course, the ultimate consequence of unaffordable housing is homelessness. According to the point in time count that was conducted by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, 14,237 people experienced homelessness in Arizona in 2023. That year, Arizona was among the states with the highest percentage of people experiencing homelessness in unsheltered locations. And then
Could you go back the slide one slide?
Mm-hmm. This one?
We had a presentation from Rachel Milnay from Phoenix, who said that Maricopa County had about 35,000 individuals who were unhoused. And I don't see that data here.
So this is the point in time count. I can look up and try to see what she might have been referencing. I don't know. So these are seeing the categories. This is counting emergency shelter, transitional housing, and unsheltered. It is possible she's citing a number that includes things like people who are couch surfing, right? Like there might be a different way of computing it, but this is the number from the point in time count that the continuum of care does.
So the point in time count is just a point in time, not a whole year. So that could be the difference that you're getting, Mindy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, Mindy, what I recall is that Rachel was talking about all the folks that were being serviced. And if you count up services throughout the year, it's going to be way different than the point in time count. The point in time count happens one day, and it's limited in scope as to where they cut off the zones and who can be included in that count. So it's grossly underestimated.
I think Tucson's point in time count for 23 was like 4,000 people, if memory serves. It was like 4,100 or something.
PPCH was just a little over 2,000.
Pima County was?
TPCH, yep, Tucson, Pima County.
Okay, then my memory's off.
But it's, again, Jim.
I could share a link, because this is just rolled up to the state, but if you wanted to see the point in time broken out, I could make a note to share a link to that.
Thank you. That would be very helpful.
Yeah, will do.
And then we can move on.
Policy. Okay, so I just have a few slides left where I wanted to talk about a few things that have happened both at the local and state level. So several cities have secured extra funding for building more units. To name a few, Tempe obtained $11 million in funding for Maricopa County for new affordable housing complexes. City of Phoenix, the council approved over $9 million in federal funding to support preservation and creation of quality, sustainable, affordable housing. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the $50 million HUD Neighborhood Implementation Grant awarded to Tucson. Congratulations on that. We've also seen some different ways people are trying to increase equity. So Tempe passed an ordinance to circumvent income discrimination in housing, trying to create more safeguards to ensure people with Section 8 vouchers or on fixed incomes would have equal access. And then there's also been a real push from cities on accessory dwelling units, ADUs. I know Tucson passed one in January of 22, and then Phoenix followed suit in September of 2023. And then at the state level, we see a similar trend toward recognizing the value of ADUs. The state passed HB 2720, which requires cities with populations of over 75,000 to allow homeowners to build ADUs. Then to address the state's gap in 2-4 unit housing, the state's also mandating that cities permit the development of this type of housing, like duplexes, triplexes. And then we saw the state provided $150 million investment into the State Housing Trust Fund, which was the largest allocation in history. And then I wanted to acknowledge, so really the person who would have been delivering this presentation from our team is Allison Cook Davis, and she is co-director of ARCHES with Kenny Wong, and she was really the lead on this particular report. She is out of office on some scheduled time off, and so that's why you got me. But I wanted to acknowledge the full team that worked on this report and then also share both my email contact and hers, because if you have specific follow-up questions, I'm happy to field those. But honestly, Allison and Kenny are probably the best people to reach out to. And then I also wanted to thank Marianne, because I know, Marianne, you You were part of the reason that this presentation happened.
Tisha.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts come to mind from this, and I have read the report, and thank you so much. It's amazing, and thank you to Kenny Wong for both the Drachman Institute and ASU for putting this together. I've used it already several times. A couple questions. One is for HCD. I know way back when we received some information regarding ADUs and permitting. I know we had information on like how much ADUs were actually being utilized or what was in the pipeline or what had people requested in regards of constructing ADUs. I think that information would be helpful on another date, just, you know, for future reference, Jay, maybe the next agenda for the next meeting. And the second thing, and Kenny, maybe you can also address this in addition to Andrea, but I'm wondering about the lag, you know, as, you know, data analysts, we worry about the data lag, and, you know, most of the information is up to 2022. Of course, it's difficult to get the 2023, 2024 data. So I'm wondering whether we have any broad ideas as to whether these trends are continuing throughout the report or getting worse, staying the same. If we can talk a bit about the data lag, that would be great.
I guess I can jump in on that one. You know, the goal is to keep updating and issuing the report as, you know, new census information and new surveys are being completed. And with this first report too, it's sort of, you know, laying out a few of the key things to pay attention to. So I would expect that, yeah, when we're already starting to gather some of the new and updated sources, thinking ahead for next year. But these are some of the areas that we'll, you know, want to keep tracking, especially, you know, things around aging in place, definitely, you know, things around evictions, and yeah, tracking prices over time. So it's, you know, I think we'll, it's sort of planting the flag for here's what we're looking at, and we'll definitely be interested to see if those trends continue.
Thanks, Kenny. Marianne?
Yeah. So, Andrea and Kenny, thank you for this. It's impressive. Like Tish has said, we've used this information as well. And so it's very informative. And I think, well, I'll be looking forward to, you know, next year's. And we'd like to have you back, I'm sure, for that presentation as soon as it comes out versus a few months later. but doesn't Tucson have an income discrimination ordinance also? We just passed that, right, in 2024. So I wanted to let you know that.
Yeah, I think Tucson and Phoenix both passed it.
Yeah,
I thought it got challenged in court and was kind of tied up in the courts. Is that right, Ann?
No, happy to jump in. We did pass it. Then it got tied up in the courts. And then when the new attorney general came in, she said it was just fine. So it is actively in effect for City of Tucson, and then City of Phoenix also passed one. Manisha, it looks like more to add there.
Just wanted to add that I posted a link in the chat if folks wanted more info on that.
Thank you.
And I think there's one in Flagstaff as well. I'm not absolutely sure.
That is not my understanding.
That is all good to know. The one thing I'll add is that, so this was the first product of Arches since it is so newly funded, and to just try to build out a template for doing this kind of statewide report the first time. These were mostly state level indicators, but I think our goal is going into next year's annual report to be able to do more where we drill down at city or county level. So hopefully that would be of even greater utility to all of you.
Thank you.
Jim?
I have a really hard question, and I apologize if this is too much, but any suggestions on things that the city of Tucson can do to help with increase the flow of affordable housing or deal with some of the issues down here?
Do you want to take that one, Kenny? I'm hesitant to speak on behalf of Tucson since I am not based there, but I feel like Kenny might have better insights that would be Tucson specific.
I guess what jumps out to me, you know, some of it is the response to the statewide legislation. You know, I think we had looked at that the housing stock that does exist across the state and where we could be building more, you know, things that are smaller scale, could be more contextual, have a little more flexibility across our neighborhoods, and definitely funding, right? Making sure that we are supporting finding ways to support development and, you know, fill in those gaps in financing to make sure projects happen. So there's a little bit of unlocking and supporting that I think a lot of the data is pointing to.
Marianne? You're muted.
I think the bond effort is really important to what's going to happen in the future with regards to housing in Tucson and Pima County. And I think we need the support of the city and our legislature and the power of the city to be able to do some lobbying along with the county to help get this passed. So I'm kind of hanging my hat on the promise of that.
One of the things that I would like to add is that, you know, we had a presentation that I mentioned at the last full commission meeting at our Equitable Housing Strategy Subcommittee on the report that I think it was also out of Drachman, and the presenter's name escapes me. Kenny, what was the name of the author of the report?
That was Bill Mackey and Greg Veach.
Right. So they presented to our subcommittee, and one of the things that I took away that I just was very, very profound was that, you know, based on Bill Mackey's work looking at zoning, he was basically saying that the zoning currently just really allows almost nowhere for multifamily housing to be built in Tucson. So, you know, obviously there is a problem with the zoning, which creates a huge equity issue because essentially the zoning code in a lot of ways is doing the most damage to the people that need housing the most because it's preventing a lot of housing from being built. There was a discussion potentially of having Bill come and present to the full commission as well. So we'll certainly talk about getting him here. Maybe in December, we'll just kind of see how the agenda plays out. So I wanted to throw that out there. And then I also had a question, Andrea, just in terms of Arches and this report. I mean, obviously there are some underlying equity issues in the report, but, you know, I don't think the report, at least from what you described, addresses equity kind of head on. So I'm just wondering, you know, as Arches gains momentum, considering equity is in the name and also in the name of this commission, what are some ways that either, you know, currently Arches is really looking at the equity issues related to housing, or, you know, going forward, how is that going to play into housing? Because I think, you know, one of the things that I want to continue to highlight is while affordable housing, building more of it obviously has impacts on equity, there are a lot of other things that go into, you know, having an equitable housing market, like evictions that you mentioned, and we're going to hear from Maxine here after you. But what are some of the ways that Arches is looking at other equity issues, if you know?
So one thing I would say is our collaboration on this is significant. So I mentioned Rockman and Morrison, but it's actually the grant was awarded across four universities. So NAU is involved, University of New Mexico. I think we have about 20 faculty who are affiliated with Arches who all have individual research projects. So this report is sort of that first cut, very high level indicator report. I think the deeper dive into some of the real equity issues is going to come forward in those individual projects where we're looking more specifically at populations, tribal issues. In Northern Arizona is where that one's happening. And then Kenny, do you want to give a couple examples of specific projects? Because we're thinking about equity in terms of multiple lenses, including things like how people experience climate change and how they adapt and how certain populations might be more vulnerable to our changing climate.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there's sort of the high level and kind of the drill down with individual projects. And, you know, we're encouraging our researchers to you know, distinguish, right, and find what's happening at a smaller grain level. But some of the more kind of direct projects too, I think one with the Southwest Fair Housing Coalition, you know, looking at what's transpiring in home sales and transactions. You know, do we see any markers in terms of what's available, what's being transferred in within or across communities of interest? So there's a few different ways that it's coming out, and even in the State of Housing report too, you know, starting to pull back some of those gaps, let's say in home ownership or rental percentages as well.
Thanks, Kenny. One of the things I would really love to encourage the ARCHES as well as this commission to think about as well is, you know, how do we balance creating a more equitable housing market that sometimes I think requires maybe new regulations like source of income protection versus, you know, freeing up the market to produce more housing, which, you know, is looking at zoning. So I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunity here for a common ground from different constituencies that maybe haven't always agreed about housing in the past. So just something that I think we can be aware of moving forward. Any other thoughts, comments, questions for Andrea? Hearing none, I want to really thank you, Andrea, for stopping by and giving a great presentation. We will certainly stay in contact as more reports come out and as this report gets updated. So again, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. And if you have things you want to highlight that Tucson is doing that you want us to help share out maybe in our next State of Housing report, you're welcome to send those to us. I'm going to have to run to pick up a kid from an after-school activity. So I'm glad the timing worked. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Next up on the agenda, we have a presentation from Maxine Becker, who is the Director of Strategic Collaborations with the Arizona Bar Foundation, looking at evictions. And she is also on the Southwest Fair Housing Council Board, where I am the Executive Director. So thank you, Maxine. The floor is yours.
So yes, I'm Maxine Becker. I'm with the Arizona Bar Foundation. If you don't know about the Arizona Bar Foundation, we are a statewide nonprofit. Our mission is to increase access to justice for all Arizonans. And we have two main sort of branches of our nonprofit. One is legal-related education, and we really focus primarily on civic education for youth. So if you are kid was part of the, you know, kid votes last week, or has ever had participated in mock trial or mock mediation, that's all wonderful programming that's done by the Bar Foundation. And then I'm a part of the Legal Services Division, where we really focus on access to justice and increasing the ability for low-income Arizonans to access our justice system. So that's just in case you have never heard of us. That's what we do. And if you, I'm not sure, do you guys have the presentation that you were going to be loading up, or do you want me to share my screen? Either way is fine. I wasn't totally sure.
Either way works with us, Maxine. I can pull it up if needed.
Yeah, if you want to do that. I'm really clumsy with that stuff. So I was kind of not totally, or I could do it too.
Sure. Let me pull it up.
Okay. And probably throw it up there too.
Okay, here we go. Sorry about that.
No, sorry.
Can everyone see my screen okay?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. So I wanted to present on the on eviction and equity in Arizona. I know we got a little bit of a preview with Andrea's presentation, but if we want to move to the next slide, this is a slide. This is one of my colleagues sent to Leslie out of Virginia, and she visited her. She was her daughter had her. She works with the Virginia Eviction Reduction Program and had to go with to her daughter's classroom for take your mom to school day, and she was really worried about what she was going to talk about evictions, and so she just asked, well, does anybody know what an eviction is? And this is just a classroom of third graders. Beautiful third graders, and they sure knew a lot about it. There's a report last year that said that 60% of households who have evictions include children, and children are not on the pleading forms. They are not in eviction court, but they are very much impacted by eviction. And we're even starting to get health equity information about what happens to children when they suffer through an eviction, and they have worse, they're showing worse health outcomes for kids. So I wanted to say, you know, sometimes when we talk about evictions, and the first part of my program is a lot about data, but when we talk, this is really what eviction is. And so we go to the next slide. The data that we traditionally have, and you see in the media, is you know, the newspaper report every month. We've been seeing certainly over the last year is, oh my goodness, you know, the eviction rates have never been higher. And we saw the graph in Andrea's report, and we'll see a little bit of that in mine as well. But there are sort of these big aggregate numbers. And so if we want to go to the next slide, what we've had and what we continue to have out of the Arizona Supreme Court provides a dashboard about evictions, and we can see that 96,000 number. This was actually from in 2023. And if we go to the next slide, you can in that Supreme Court dashboard sort of slice and dice and get sort of these big numbers. But then you can look by county and see where we're having those issues. And you can see, of course, Maricopa with the monster share there. But you can have a sense of what's happening throughout the state. If you go one more level, go to the next slide, you can even see by court. And I know down in Pima County, you all have all of your evictions now consolidated into one justice court. So you have one consistent judge that hears those cases, which I think is you've done a wonderful, amazing work down in Tucson on eviction since the pandemic. In Maricopa County, we have about 25 justice courts. And so those are all, you know, they all have their own judges who are elected. And so we have different outcomes in each of those courts, but it's just wanted to point that out. And so you can see this website in and of itself, you can really slice and dice different kinds of things to get some understanding geographically of what's happening with evictions. And Wendy has her hand raised. So.
Yeah, so I just wanted to correct in Pima County. So in Pima County Consolidated Justice Court, it's only in Tucson that there's usually one judge who hears it.
Right.
There are other judges in Green Valley, Ajo, et cetera. So it's only in Tucson.
That's correct. Thank you for that correction. I appreciate that.
And if I could say, it has its advantages and disadvantages. I'm at legal aid, so I don't know you, but you know, my colleagues go to court and are heard in front of Judge Newman on a daily basis. And the advantage is that we do get an opportunity to educate him. However, when he is locked himself in place on a particular issue, there's no budging. And if we were heard by different justices occasionally, that might have different impact for some of our clients.
I understand that for sure.
So some advantages, some not so advantages. He is holding landlords' feet to the fire when it comes to procedural errors, but on some more nuanced legal matters, not as much as we would like.
I understand.
I thought you would.
We can go to the next slide. Then I wanted to, so those are sort of the big numbers that I wanted to talk about. If we wanted to look at the There's another project that I've been working on over the last year, and this is the Arizona Eviction and Foreclosure Dashboard. And when it comes to equity, this in any court, and this is not it's not just in Arizona, but in court, they don't take demographic information about what who's in front of them. So we don't when we see those numbers, we don't know are they elderly, are they what race are they, single families. We have no idea what their income is or anything about them personally. And so the Arizona Eviction Foreclosure Dashboard, if you want to go to the next slide, was a collaborative effort between New America, which is basically like a think tank out of Washington, D.C. ASU was a huge part of this, really doing the data. And then I just sort of helped along the way to get to sort of provide the context. But yeah, we don't, there's no demographic that information that's collected. And so what this site does is it overlays data from the Census Bureau over our eviction data. So we have get a little bit better sense of where the evictions are happening and who they're likely happening to. And so if we want to go to the next slide, what I did was I just took some screenshots of Pima County so that you could have a sense of where it looks like where evictions are happening. And we're gonna, this particular site are lots and lots of places that you can slice and dice, and we're gonna go through sort of a sampling of that. But the hope is that when you understand more about who eviction is happening to and where it's happening, we can look more closely at, well, what are some other things happening in those communities? And what are the resources maybe that are lacking to these particular populations to assist in their in their housing instability. And so this this particular just sort of maps out and shows the different neighborhoods of Tucson. And the, as you can see on the side, the lighter the blue, the more the higher the eviction rate. And so one thing I will tell you about this particular tool is that this is the mapped eviction judgment rate. First of all, not all of that we were able to receive through the generosity and hard work of the court system eviction data that had been redacted. And from all the different courts around the state. So, and because they're all, they're basically there's Maricopa, there's Pima, and then the rest of the state is that data goes to the Office of Administrative, the Administrative Office of the Courts. It was kind of, they're all a little bit different on how they provided the data, but we were able to map them. Not we, but ASU, very smart data people over there. And then we can go to the next slide. But it's the mapped eviction rate, which is not, sometimes you will hear people talk about, well, evictions are so high because our population is so, it got, has gotten so big. And that's why evictions are higher than, so, but this particular tool does not go by that. This goes by the mapped eviction rate is, what is the eviction rate in a particular actually census tract, evictions at, over how many how much rental housing is in that particular area. So you're really getting a sense of how much eviction is happening, not just based on, oh gosh, well, there's a lot of people moving here, so of course the evictions are gonna go up. No, this is actually looking, tying it to the rental housing data. So in this particular slide, it shows that the slice is, we have court boundaries, the mapped eviction rate, and also the zip codes. So here you could look, if you wanted to look up a particular zip code and think about, okay, what's happening in here? Maybe it's a school or it's a particular service agency that wants to understand more about what's happening in different areas or the state or the city. This can help you get a better idea of what's happening on the ground. And so you can light up those boundaries and it will show you that information. And then we can go to the next slide. And then you can like look into by zip code. And so here, I don't know if you can see on sort of the that mid right on the right hand side, a little 85710 is outlined in purple. And we can look at that. And in that particular zip code, the mapped eviction rate was 1.09%. There were 122 evictions and 11,224 households. And if we go one more, that's only through from January to May of 2024. We haven't gotten another tranche of data. If we want to go to the next slide, and then we can even go down to the census tract level. And this one shows here for this one census tract. It looks like it's south of Speedway, above Golf Links, and I think it's Wilmette, over in that corridor over there. We had 11 eviction judgments for 296 renters, and we can really dig into the census data and understand the population that that's really impacting. And we see that there's a higher proportion of some minority populations there, high population of elderly folks, and a very high population of mobile homeowners. And so we think that, hopefully having, and then it gives you all of the census data. So you can understand median, you can understand education and their rate of pay and all kinds of things, whether or not they have internet. So all kinds of information that we can try to put together on understanding the impact of eviction in our communities. So we can go to the next slide. And Wendy, I see your hand is still up. So I'm not sure if you still have a question or just kind of hanging out up there. Okay, cool. And then this is one other feature of the map that shows the different you can also slice it by legislative districts. So for advocacy purposes or making sure your legislator understands what the impact of eviction is in your area and how it's impacting their constituents and what your area may be needing from the state, we can look at that as well. So we hope that those are useful tools to be able to understand the impacts a little bit better and get some more data-driven information rather than, I mean, we obviously, if you're in a service agency, certainly have story after story about how housing instability is impacting your population, but also having data to back that up or to show somebody that might not understand that evictions happen in their legislative district. No, we know, and here it is, and here it's all lit up, and we can show you what it looks like. And Ray asked whether or not we could look at just mobile homes, and we can't. We didn't have that kind of capability with this tool. So we can't just look at mobile home evictions, and they also are not parsed by the courts. So evictions, mobile home, and residential are just all lumped into one basket. We don't know from the court data what's a mo which one is a mobile home eviction and which one isn't. And Jim has his hands raised. Jim and Marianne. So Jim first.
Thanks for the presentation. So just in terms of talking of mobile homes, and Ray, I don't know if Steve Toefel contacted you, but something that I was made aware of recently is there's a lot of predatory stuff happening with the mobile home parks because individuals are coming in, buying mobile home parks, jacking up the rent, and it's very cost prohibitive for somebody to leave a mobile home park. It's not like moving from one apartment to another. They own the home, and it costs a lot of money to move that. And if they get behind, the landlord can take possession of the mobile home. So it's much more damaging as well. So that would be something in particular, I think, that would be, if there was a way to address that issue, I think that there's a lot of predatory stuff happening there right now.
I was just going to add, Jim, that we Ray actually contacted me recently about potentially having some sort of study commission or be part of one of our subcommittees, a group that can look more deeply into mobile homes and particularly, I think, the issue that you raised. So that might be something that to kind of keep your ears open for. I think we're going to be able to put it on the December meeting agenda so we can talk about it and get that off the ground. So thank you. Go ahead, Marianne.
I think that's a really good idea, Jay and Ray. These slides are I don't know what these charts are fabulous. And the reason I'm excited about it is that if we can go deeper into like that 85710 area and look at, what are the lack, what's the lack of access to services and opportunities, not just education, but like food and healthcare, all that in these areas that might be draining the dollar you know, from people that also helps with them not being able to pay the rent. But I think this is fantastic and well done. And I would be very interested in if there was a selection of an area, not just a housing type, but an area that has the highest evictions, to look at a way to do some kind of pilot way to tackle that. I'm on board. I'm on board. That's just really good work there.
Yeah, we're very hopeful. It's useful. And if you do use it in any work, we'd love to know about it. We've presented it to HUD. We've presented as many places as we can to really try to show the value of the data so that we can try to be able to bring more resources to the areas that we know maybe need to be targeted. So,
can you send these out?
Yeah, you can look at, I'm not very good at multitasking, but I can put the link. This is all, you can get, this is all, everybody can access it. You can get in there and tootle around with it and play with it and learn how to use it. Absolutely. So, Ray?
Yeah, thank you so much for this presentation. Just building upon what Marianne was saying, I think not only looking at lack of resources in some areas, but also some of the landlords that are really fueling the evictions. I think being able to map that might help people who are organizing to be able to check in with residents in those communities and really see some of the practices that are happening. So thank you.
Yeah. I have a little bit more of my presentation if you want to keep going. Sorry, there's one more little spot.
Keep going.
And then this is another section of evidence. We do, the entire state is now mapped. And so I just wanted to point that out as well. But I'll try to get before the end of your meeting, I'll put the link to the website in the chat. So if you want to keep going to the next slide, then I wanted to sort of round this out by the next section is just equity in eviction court. So now we kind of know who's being evicted. And if you want to go to the next section, I think I wanted to just sort of level set on what the challenges are for legal representation in Arizona. We rank 49th per capita in the number of legal resources available to residents. So we don't have very many lawyers, period, for the number of folks who live here in Arizona. And then we also have legal deserts, and those are areas where there are 2/3 of the counties have fewer than one lawyer per 1,000 residents. And, you know, where that is really impactful, like recently there was something that came to our attention at the foundation that there were folks in a rural area of Arizona who they had disabled children who were now adults, and they needed to have guardianship over those kiddos and who are now adults. And finding an attorney that could help them with the paperwork and getting a guardianship filed is a real life issue. And there were no lawyers where they lived. And so that's a real problem. So that's sort of just a level set on just the lack of general resources we have. And then if we want to go to the next slide, it's an eviction court. It's also, we have those inequities. We have over 96% of the landlords are represented and less than 1% of the tenants. And I'm sure that's not news to anyone else. But I see that Tisha has her hand up. So I want to make sure I saw that. Thank you.
Thank you, Maxine. Yeah, I have a question on the data. So what's the time frame for the data and how much support do you have to continue putting the data in?
Yeah, so that was kind of the sad trombone about this project. So for Pima County, we got the first half of the year came. And so that's updated through May of 24. The balance of the state, we got all of 2023's data in, and they sort of wait like a full year before they release all that data. Just as we were getting this up and running, ASU decided that it's Knowledge Exchange for Resilience, which was the center where this project was being housed, they're sunsetting that program. So we, at the moment, are a little homeless and not sure exactly how this project is going to continue. But we don't know. We're hoping that we'll be able to navigate that somehow. Now that we did a ton of work to get it going and making sure we knew how to do all the coding, but it's a little bit, it's up to date, I think, as much as it can be for now, but I know by next year it won't be unless we figure it out. So sort of a sad coda to that. Yes, Marianne.
So, Kenny, this might be a good conversation with Drachman and Morrison because of the type of research you do. I mean, this, you know, falls right into digging in deep and getting those details with regards to inequities and evictions. I think it's worth a conversation. And Maxine, I really recommend that you reach out to Andrea at the Morrison Institute.
I can just throw in there, you know, Patricia Solis from the Knowledge Exchange for Resilience, she is one of our Arches researchers. So I'm not exactly sure, you know, there are different projects within the center, of course. And so, yeah, I think it warrants, you know, finding ways to support the project. And at the same time, I'm sure it's on the minds of Patricia over there.
Yeah, I'm sure it is too. And they've got a lot going on. So we're just sort of happy that we've got it up and running and we can share it. And then we're hopeful we'll be able to continue it somehow. If you want to go to the next slide. So Arizona is one of three states that has no state funding for civil legal aid. We are in the company, as far as we know, we of Alabama and Idaho. Every other state gets state funding. I know Wendy's on the call, so she's well aware. The primary funder comes from for our legal aids is federal funding through the Legal Services Corporation, but we're almost completely reliant on that. So if that goes away, that would be completely devastating. Just to give a comparison, that other states, the amount of money that goes into their legal aid organizations, Texas, they get $60 million. Illinois, the same. Ohio, I mean, millions of dollars, and we have zero. So if we go to the next slide, we have, so this is available legal resources. I should have said civil legal aid resources. We have about 78 civil legal aid program lawyers for a statewide low-income population of over 1 million people. So, and it's really hard for your clients and to access legal aid. We just don't have enough. And only a very small portion of that 78 are our housing attorneys. So when it comes to it's completely overwhelmed by the lack of resources and the lack of attorneys that are available to provide the resources. And those 78 lawyers in those civil legal aid programs are heroes, but they can only do so much in a day. So if you want to go, I think I have one more slide. Oh, and there are some emerging programs. I know Ray is on the call and she is a housing stability legal advocate. These are emerging programs where we have non-lawyers are trained specifically on eviction assistance for tenants. And they are where this was a program that was approved by the Arizona Supreme Court. And I think it has a lot of promise to add to the resource of it. I think we can always think about, well, you know, we all, as far as equity goes, I mean, we have to keep in mind that landlords are almost always represented by a barred attorney, you know, that's been practicing for a very long time. And all the laws are in their favor and they still show up with that attorney. And we need to be asking, well, why is that? And so I think we have to continue to pump resources into and innovate and find more ways of getting people legal education and legal help. And I think it needs to be a both and, where we need to continue to be innovative, but we need to continue to look at how we continue to support our lawyers, because they can't exist without each other. I'm excited that Primavera also has a cohort going through. So those are going to be really important resources, particularly given sort of the housing challenges that we all have. But that's all that I have on my presentation. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thanks, Maxine. Any other questions or comments for Maxine?
This was very helpful. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Mindy.
I'm slightly astounded with all of this data and am wondering if, as the commission members, we might want to dig into this a little bit more. To provide recommendations to mayor and council. And then, of course, some discourse on what kind of recommendation would we be wanting to move forward if that's the will of other commissioners. I'm so moved. Thank you so much for doing the work on getting this report to us. Thank you.
Happy to do that.
Hi, so I have one other comment. You know, I appreciate you mentioning that Arizona is one of three states. It doesn't have a permanent line item in our state budget to provide funding for legal services. It's kind of embarrassing. But the other piece about Arizona that makes us unfortunately unique is that we are one of the states that doesn't have right to counsel in housing cases. And so states where it's been mandated that you can have a lawyer appointed to you, not only does that provide funding for legal services and housing matters, but what we find when we go to court is that even when a client doesn't have, tenant doesn't have a great defense, the impact of having a lawyer there, being able to see the systemic issues, has a tremendous impact. And we're appreciative that we've gotten some funding from the county and the city to provide legal services and housing matters, because that gives us an opportunity to go to court more often. That is a systemic change that would make a difference. Arizona's legislature, in addition to having a landlord-tenant act that is so landlord-favorable, would make one of those small steps of making one thing more tenant-favorable, which would be to have a right to counsel.
Thanks, Wendy. Any other questions or comments? I guess just kind of building on what Wendy was just mentioning, do we know what the impact of attorneys are? Are there any examples of places where, you know, everybody who is going to eviction court has an attorney and what that does? Because, you know, obviously, at least it seems obvious to me, if you haven't paid your rent for a couple of months and you're getting evicted and, you know, the landlord has followed all of the, you know, rules and procedures, an attorney's not necessarily going to help. So, you know, I guess I'm just kind of wanting to parse out, you know, how much of this is about legal representation, and then how much of this is about, you know, other issues like poverty or other things that are leading to evictions. I don't know if you can answer that question, Maxine, but just wondering if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, the best single investment we can make in housing stability are lawyers in the courtroom. That drives down the number of forced displacement dramatically. It may not be able to prevent someone from having to leave their home, but that lawyers can negotiate settlements, lawyers can negotiate more time, lawyers can make sure that their client understands the judgment that's being entered against that client. Because going through this process is a traumatic process. It's one of the most traumatic things that you can undergo. I also have the ability to I volunteer with the ASU Unhoused Legal Assistance Program, and I go down and I work with folks in the shelter. And I was not prepared when I started last year as that volunteer supervising the law students how many people wanted to come in and talk about their eviction. And they are suspended in time. I will tell you, last time I went, which was last week or 2 weeks ago, I had a woman who was home. She was homeless. She had been evicted. And she said, I'm evicted. I'll never be able to get a house again. I'll never be able to get an apartment. And I said, okay, well, when was it? And let's talk about it. She wanted to just kind of talk about it. I said, well, let's look up. She's like, I can't even look at my eviction because I'm so stressed and so terrified about how much money I owe. And I said, well, let's look it up together. Because she's like, I got out of the hospital. I didn't know what was going on. I got this notice and I just left. Or maybe she didn't even say that, but she said, I didn't know what was going on. So I said, let's look at it together. And we opened it up and the judgment had been sealed. And so she was living in, and so she, because nobody was there to explain the process to her. And so she started crying. I started crying, you know, and so I was like, you don't have an eviction against you, you know, but she was suspended in fear because she didn't understand the process. And so those kinds of things are having a lawyer to explain those things and to advocate, it's life changing. And so it's the absolute best return on an investment. You can look in Philadelphia, you can look in Virginia, you can look in any, you know, Minnesota, all over the country, in New York City, that where we have those programs, we're driving down eviction rates and eviction judgments. People may still have to leave, but they can leave with a plan. They can leave with dignity. They can leave without trauma. And that helps them get on with their lives. And I think that's the best investment we can make. So it's not my TED talk.
The other thing I wanted to kind of add to that is that, you know, also if you're just thinking about people hiring a private attorney who are facing eviction, even if they have the funding, finding a landlord-tenant attorney who will be able to help you, that's not too busy, that, you know, could step in the time frame that you're dealing with. All of those things, even if you have the wherewithal and resources, I think is incredibly challenging, you know, and thinking about the vast majority of folks who are getting evicted, you know, the situations they're in, you know, I think Maxine, your example just really illustrates the emotional challenge that people also face in dealing with this on their own and without an attorney and essentially having very little help. And you know, one of the things that I'm really supportive of, in addition to the attorneys being available for folks, is also, you know, the program that you mentioned, what is it, the HSLA program, where, you know, folks are able to get some training and help people through the process. You know, even though, you know, in my opinion, the law is really tilted in favor of landlords, you know, the majority of people that contact our office that are facing eviction, they don't know the rights that they do have, even if they are limited. So, you know, having, even if it's not an attorney, having someone who is knowledgeable to, you know, put up some guideposts for people, like, you need to do this by this date, you need to, you know, show up in court. These are the things that you absolutely have to do. You know, I think there are some things that can be done in kind of that middle space as well. So, yeah, there's just so much to be done, I think, that could really help this situation. So again, thanks for the presentation. Kenny, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation and just a lot of good information around this particular issue. I was curious, with the right to counsel around some of the housing, you know, issues or courts, is that something that could be implemented at a local level, or are there, you know,
so it's based on statute. So, mm-hmm. You know, the thing with statute is that there's state statute and there are also resolutions and policies, et cetera, that a city can do. So we have discrimination and a source of income discrimination that's not statewide. It's specific to Tucson. So there possibility, I think, probably the biggest thing is to, you know, in the medium term, is to make the funding available for attorneys to be there, even if outright we don't have some kind of change in the laws that mandate right to counsel. I mean, one of the things that we've seen is, you know, the county has the EELS program that's provided a significant amount of funding to Southern Arizona Legal Aid and at least one of the other nonprofits in town that provide legal services, as well as contracted attorneys. So even without the mandate, it's allowed us to go to court much more often. And what we see is all of the things that Maxine mentioned, which is gives an opportunity to negotiate a different outcome. It can allow the tenant to have a little bit more time or a payment plan in place that they're unlikely to be able to negotiate on their own. It also allows us to see a lot of procedural defects in filings that have happened, which has protected a lot of tenants that otherwise wouldn't be protected. Because how do they know how to read a 5-day notice? How do they know how to read a complaint? I went to law school and I don't always know how to read those. You know, I have colleagues who have more experience in that area of law right now, that it's complicated. And so the whole system is so slanted towards landlords, including the fact that the procedures for evictions are an expedited proceeding. So that even if you had the money to hire an attorney, finding an attorney who was available on such short notice, and even if you could find one with the expertise, because the attorneys who know landlord-tenant law represent landlords, they don't represent tenants. So there's a lack of support for tenants everywhere they turn.
That's helpful to hear. I guess my quick follow-up is, you know, I was kind of interested in the local jurisdictions too, to kind of see, is there a gap in coverage like statewide where people might have access to support? So I don't know if you would have any more information or know about where are some of the glaring gaps.
I mean, to be completely honest, there's a glaring gap everywhere. I think Tucson does the best job. But you know, there's a sheer number of tenants that face eviction and the amount of legal resources that are available. I mean, it's just so disproportionate. I would just also add, Tucson may still have a voluntary sort of settlement or diversion program, but we have the only ramp is through eviction court. You know, we don't really have any offshoots. So we don't have any ability to mediate or have settlement disputes or, you know, have anything like that, where I think particularly if we have, you know, non-lawyer representation could be an incredible place for folks to be. But we don't have that. So we're working on some projects that, you know, maybe we'll try to start those conversations, but we don't even have that. So
there used to be community mediation where a landlord and a tenant could go and have a restorative process. The problem currently is there's very little motivation for a landlord to participate in any kind of diversion or mediation because they have the upper hand. Now, I think that could potentially shift, particularly as we're seeing a little bit of this where landlords are having some problems renting because they raise the rent so much. So maybe they don't want to get rid of a tenant who might be able to enter into a payment plan. So one of the driving forces in why so many people get evicted is all of the economic problems that people have as individuals, but also the fact that we have an incredibly greedy landlord environment. The more we have property owners who are not local, the less likely it is that they're going to be interested in what the impact is on our community. I mean, it's kind of the worst case scenario. It's like a perfect storm of how to get evicted. And the only improvement I have seen in terms of changes in the law recently is the sealing of evictions so that they don't always sit there in public, accessible in public light. So if you've had your eviction dismissed, it's gone. You can't find it. It doesn't show up in the public records anymore. Whereas those used to just sit there, and then the burden was on, you know, a tenant looking for a place to try and explain to their potential landlord that, no, this case was dismissed. And they're going to say, but it's still there. And so that is an improvement, but it's one of very few.
I think, Wendy, also that shows that. And then, you know, if you look at what happened during the pandemic, you know, why did evictions go down by half? Well, the policy was changed. So, you know, policy matters here. And, you know, the policy trade-offs sometimes are that, you know, the landlord, groups are, you know, maybe taking a hit on their bottom line or whatever. There are obviously trade-offs, but, you know, policy obviously matters. It's not, this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. So,
the other reality that happened during the pandemic is that there were tremendous amounts of rental assistance available. And right now there's hardly any again. It's back to how it was before the pandemic, where maybe if your timing was good and disabled or elderly or a family, you might be able to get rental assistance. But right now, we're having clients say, I called everybody on the lists that I can find and nobody has money, which is what we used to hear years ago. So that's another piece. You know, it's like some folks need like just a little bit of stopgap, 1 month's rent, and they wouldn't end up getting evicted. That's a place where a small financial investment from the community could make a huge difference in the number of people who actually end up getting evicted.
Maggie, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes. How can, you know, how can the housing counseling services partner with maybe SALA to help mitigate this? I know that our, you know, we're blessed to have 3 HUD certified housing counselors at PCCLT, and everyone just, they want monetary assistance. And it's like, well, wait. I mean, it's a little easier when we do foreclosure counseling, because we, you know, we talk to loss mitigation, we're able to negotiate payment plans or forbearance or whatever that is. But with evictions, it's proven to be very difficult. And I'm wondering, you know, we need to obviously step up our game in being better prepared to help people with their tenant rights. But also, I think, you know, so how do we partner? And perhaps there could be, you know, some kind of a educational component where we partner with Southern Arizona Legal Aid and with EELS to provide maybe more information to the tenants that come in our door. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I know staff is very discouraged. They're feeling like, what can we do? There's no money, you know, out there. So just a question. How can, you know, there are a lot of housing counseling agencies in town. And I know Primavera does a wonderful job. And I'm just wondering how we can replicate these services, if, you know, just any suggestions?
I think starting to have those conversations, sitting down and, you know, maybe it's sometimes it's a big elephant to take that first bite out of, but understanding, if you understand each other's programs, and figure out where those entry points may be or whether they're up, it's upstream support, whether it's, you know, more, I think there's just, you know, having those conversations and trying to figure that out is really important, even if it's just, you know, a little bit at a time.
Addition.
Yeah, I just have one more question, Maxine. Yeah. I'm wondering about those folks. So we see quite a few folks that already have a number of evictions. And that serves as a huge impediment. The only way around that we've found is, you know, getting relationships with landlords and, you know, making a case for each person. Is there any, you know, aside from getting an eviction sealed or getting it dismissed prior to it getting on a record, is there anything that you know or any of the advocates or lawyers in the Arizona Bar Association have worked on as a strategy for that particular piece?
Yeah, I will tell you, we did attempt to file a rule change petition that would have allowed people to vacate their judgments. It would require them to pay it. But that would have, so it would have been a post, you know, a post eviction relief opportunity. And the Supreme Court denied that petition a couple of years ago. I mean, I think, you know, and Wendy can weigh in as well. I mean, I think that your strategy of working with the tenant, working with the landlord, developing that relationship, if there is a way, you know, it's tricky now too, because those judgments but go to collection agencies, and then they have to manage that process. And I feel like maybe we need to do a better job on educating what that looks like, and how you could work with the collection agency to see if there's a way to get that resolved and then provide that as a satisfaction of judgment. There's some education pieces there that I think we need to keep working on with folks. But But I think you're doing it exactly right. And if, you know, there is the capability of paying it, or if there are flexible funds that could be made available to help pay back some of that judgment, I think that could also give people a boost and give them some hope and give them motivation to keep going. I think that's also really huge, because I will tell you, it's just, there are people are just suspended in their lives because of this crisis that they had. And I think we need to figure out some better solutions, because we don't have great ones.
Mindy, I think you had your hand up, and I think I missed you. Did you have a comment?
I did. From the reading that I've also done, is that very often people who are getting evicted are just short a little bit of money, or how, you know, just that extra $300 would have kept them in their apartment. I wrote a grant once for a rental assistance for clients in my program, where they could, when they lost their apartment or housing with no fault of their own, could borrow money for first and last month and utility turn on and set up a payment. It was through the Arizona Found Community Foundation of Southern Arizona. They and 8 out of 10 people paid us back, you know, paid back money to that pot, so it would be available for others. And it'd be the $300 that that whatever would go out to individuals to keep them in their housing in that crisis is like minuscule compared to what we spend on emergency rooms, first responders, encampment cleanup, and plus the indignities of being homeless. People staying in their housing usually can keep their job, so they're paying taxes, and there's lots of many. Yeah, I would love to see that kind of fund happen in Tucson. That's all I had to say. Thanks, Jay.
Go ahead, Tisha.
Yeah, Jay, I think based on this discussion, we obviously need to set this as eviction prevention as an agenda item for another meeting. Thank you.
For sure. That sounds like a good idea. I just w wanted to make another comment or two as well. You know, I think to Maggie, to your point, you know, there's so many ways for our various organizations to work together, but at the end of the day, I think the incentives are just really not there for us to work together. We're all so busy getting done the things that we're getting paid to do. It's just that kind of coalition building, at least in my experience, seems to be very challenging because the incentives are not there. You know, the other thing too that strikes me about eviction prevention and funds to keep people in their homes. You know, when the moratorium was in effect and there was actually a lot of money, you know, relatively speaking, to help people stay in their homes, the landlord-tenant lobby was opposed to essentially everything that we're talking about. So, you know, I think there are a lot of things that we know could help, but at the end of the day, this is a really political issue, and the things that we think are no-brainers that would be, you know, easy to do a few $100 here and there. Once you start floating those ideas up into the political realm, they are met with very fierce and intractable resistance. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for, you know, knowing what to do but not being able to do it. So, but Tish, I love your idea about, you know, setting this aside as another agenda topic or something that we tackle as well. You know, I think there was some energy around the situation with mobile homes and mobile home parks as well. Obviously, two things I think that, you know, sound like things we want to dig into. Is there anything else, any other questions or comments for Maxine before we let her go?
Thank you.
Thanks, Maxine. We appreciate the time. And obviously, I think you've, touched a nerve on the commission, and certainly appreciate the presentation and all the work that you've done in the eviction realm. So thank you.
Oh, I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much. It was lovely to meet you all.
All right, everybody. Let me take a look at the agenda. And we kind of jumped around. but I think we're getting close to the end here. We've had our two major presentations, the HCD update, Pima County Housing Commission update. I think we've just got a couple more things, the subcommittee updates, and then next steps, and we should be on track, I think, to make it out of here on time. I can start with the Equitable Housing Strategies Subcommittee report because we met last time right before the last full commission meeting, and we haven't met since. And also just to announce, if I don't know that it's gone out, but the Equitable Housing Strategies Subcommittee meeting next week is canceled because I have a bunch of grants that I'm working on. I don't have time. So there's that. Next group would be next subcommittee, affordable housing. Do you have a report?
So we did not meet this last month. We've been trying to coordinate a meeting with the county. As I mentioned, I'm going to speak tomorrow at the county's housing commission, but we are going to meet this next month. So I'll have a better report next time around.
That's good. Thanks, Jim. Housing first.
We did not have quorum. We did not meet.
All right. Well, that was easy. Not a lot going on with the subcommittees this time around. On to the next agenda item, which is next steps. Let's see. So just a few details. The next commission meeting is December 5th from 4 to 6, and it's a hybrid meeting. And I see on here that there's a in-person meeting discussion. When is the next in-person meeting, Rachel?
Yeah, that next in-person meeting will be December 5th, but we will have a hybrid option available for folks. We do have the Sentinel building here at HCD booked, but I know there were some conversations the last time if we wanted to hold the meeting elsewhere.
Any thoughts, y'all? Obviously, we have a place that we can go that we know, but I'm certainly open to other places.
I could, if you guys are interested, I could talk to the Foundation for Senior Living about using their conference room at the Marist, which is an affordable housing project downtown on Congress and Church. On the seventh floor, parking would be a little bit more difficult down there, but we could do a tour of the building, see what, you know, if that's something that interests you guys, I'm happy to ask. I'm sure they'd do it for us.
We also have a conference room at Southern Arizona Legal Aid. I don't have access to looking at the calendar at the same time that we're here, but something late in the afternoon is usually okay.
Both Jim and Wendy, do the places that you guys recommended, do they have technology set up to do a hybrid meeting that would be effective?
Yeah, we have, the Wi-Fi is not great in our conference room, but we do have outlets. So we could, you know, get a cable into a laptop.
I don't know. I'll ask.
We do Teams meetings in our conference room all the time, so, and Zoom meetings. So,
Vicki?
I just want to say not having good Wi-Fi is problematic to have an accessible meeting via Zoom. It's been difficult the way they've been going.
So let me just clarify. The Wi-Fi in our building in various locations is not great, but we can hardwire a laptop. We just plug it in.
I mean, we need better speakers or microphones because the way the meetings are now, you can only hear people that are very close to the laptop.
Yeah, I think we would need it, wherever we meet, if we're going to do a hybrid meeting, it needs to be set up at the very least as well as good as the space that the city has. Go ahead, Tisha.
Yeah, I'm happy to host if the commission would be interested. You've been to the room. Jay, I think a few other people have too. In the training center in South Tucson, we actually have two big monitors and we have an owl. So it will actually, when you're talking, it'll zoom into you and with the microphone so that people can hear. I know that that's been a problem for those who has not been in person, and especially in regards to attendees who may not be in person, they'd actually be able to see us up close and hear us in our facility.
You win because you have the owl.
Marianne?
I'm just wondering, is this the reason that the conversation came up to find someplace else, is because people couldn't hear?
No, we did have the Sentinel booked, but I think there were other conversations for in other meetings. I forget if it was the previous meeting, but someone had suggested maybe we meet at another location too, maybe a more centralized location.
Well, it is a problem hearing at the meetings, and I love Tisha's idea, and thank you for volunteering. That sounds awesome.
That's what Vicky's, sorry.
Go ahead.
To Vicky's point, also, if we do have the meeting in the Sentinel, I'll be sure to coordinate with the United Way IT team just to make sure if the sensitivity and like the microphone sensitivity in that room needs to be adjusted, or if we need to purchase something like a conference microphone to have better meeting audio in the future as well. Happy to do that.
Yeah. Tisha, is your hand up from previously, or it's okay. I guess I would vote to do it at Primavera. I think I'm with Vicky. If we're going to have hybrid meetings, I think we need to really have the best technology because, yeah, I would even say, you know, if we can't do that every time, that we need to either have in-person meetings or virtual meetings. Hybrid meetings, I just think are really bad because of the technology is challenging. So that would be my vote. Would everybody be okay with us doing it at Primavera and, you know, using their technology? And I think parking's pretty good down there as well. So,
yes, but this is Vicky. I am not okay with requiring in-person meetings. I think there has to be a hybrid option.
All right, noted. So why don't we settle on Primavera if everybody's okay with that for the hybrid meeting, see how that goes. We will obviously get the information out to folks about, you know, where it is and how to get there. And again, that is December 5th from 4 to 6. Future agenda items. So there are a couple of things that are on the agenda today for potential future agenda items. One is the presentation on the Safe and Vibrant City Sales Tax Initiative from the city manager's office. And I believe that is the, if I'm not mistaken, that's the bond issue, right? That's supposedly going before the voters. Is that accurate? Am I making that up?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Also a presentation on development impact fees from the Planning and Development Services Department is another thing. Obviously I mentioned earlier, Bill Mackey's presentation about zoning and the impact that that's having on the construction of multifamily and affordable housing. Obviously, we had a great conversation about evictions today that, you know, I think warrants further discussion, and then mobile homes. So, you know, there's a lot to discuss. And one of the things that I would like to bring up with the group is, to me, this really calls to mind how we're working together as a commission and, you know, making sure that we're having time for some deliberative process. You know, I think, you know, at the next meeting, it sounds like we will be able to have facilitation. So I think, you know, one of the things we need to do as a group, and maybe this should be front and center on our agenda, is, you know, how are we working with the facilitators? You know, what are we expecting of them? What can they do for us? And I think that plays into, you know, one of my wishes, which is that, again, we have opportunity for more deliberation and conversation about the things that we're hearing in these meetings. And, you know, there's also been some discussion about, you know, just essentially spending all of our commission time, meeting time, really just hearing presentations. And I think that, you know, goes to the greater idea of, you know, how we're getting recommendations to mayor and council. So obviously we have our subcommittees where that's supposed to be happening to a certain extent, but I do think that there's room to have more deliberation as a group, as a full commission. So I don't exactly know how that could play out, or if that what that sounds like to the group. But those are some of my thoughts. What do y'all think about at our next meeting on December 5th, having an agenda item about, you know, how we're working as a group, you know, how we're discussing things, and have that be really part of discussing with the facilitators how we can work with them going forward. What does that sound like to the group? Go ahead, Marianne.
I think it's a good idea. I also think that having that time to deliberate is a good idea. So for this particular discussion where we deliberate on how we're going to do this, I think we need to be given enough time. And so, you know, 30 minutes at least or something like that for us to be able to deliberate on things.
Sounds great. Thanks, Marianne. Mindy, did you have a comment?
No, I've been sending hearts.
I just saw you were off mute, so thought you might have something to say. Love the heart stuff. Let's see. Anything else that's on folks' minds in terms of future agenda items we haven't talked about today? Okay. Obviously, we've got some things to discuss and some things for several agendas, I think, for the next couple of meetings. So that sounds good. And then finally, in terms of, go ahead, Mindy. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. This is the season where people are coming together and eating and drinking and celebrating winter. And I was wondering if the December meeting, we could bring that in to share with each other, or go out afterwards and share someplace else. I just throwing it out there.
I'll be happy to make sure that we have festive snacks and beverages.
Thanks, Tisha. Yeah, and I would say if people want to bring stuff to share with the group, that certainly would be welcome.
Hot luck.
Yeah.
Or snacks. Thanks.
Sure. The last thing on next steps are our upcoming subcommittee meetings. As I mentioned, the Equitable Housing Strategy subcommittee meeting for next Tuesday is canceled. Affordable housing is Wednesday, November 20th from 4 to 6. And then Housing First is Tuesday, November 26th from 4 to 5:30, unless those have changed. And again, just one more opportunity, if there are anything else that the group would like to discuss regarding next steps, because if not, I'm going to adjourn us. All right. Thanks, everybody. We are adjourned.
Thank you so much.
Have a great evening.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.